what Jesus wants most of all the last couple of Sundays. And today I think we're really looking at who Jesus trusts most of all. And it's quite possible that these verses aren't the only verses being referred to on this day, but there may be more who are referring to these verses that we're going to be looking at than any others on this day. We pointed out in class, I wanted to make a point of it, that Mother's Day is actually not just a Hallmark holiday that was created to sell cards. It was actually had very noble origins that go back to the efforts to help bring healing after the Civil War. A woman by the name of Anna Reeves Jarvis laid the foundation for what would become Mother's Day by creating Mother's Day work clubs. And these clubs were designed to help bring reconciliation. Not everyone in all of the communities, even if they were in the North or the South, necessarily agreed with the outcome of the war. And so there was a lot of healing that needed to happen. And so the clubs were designed to bring reconciliation by focusing on concerns that every community shared, like public health and children's welfare. And, you know, there were an awful lot of fatherless children by that time because of how many men died in the war. And so these were things that mothers were especially concerned about. And even though they didn't work outside the home, they worked awfully hard in the homes. So it wasn't like they had all the time in the world, but they had the hearts of mothers. And then there was also Julia Ward Howe, the author of the Battle Hymn of the Republic, who also joined in, and she made a significant contribution through her Mother's Day proclamation written in 1870. You can look that up. It's quite a proclamation. We read it in class, but it called upon mothers to unite in promoting global peace, just putting an end to war altogether as a solution to our problems. Okay, but here are the verses from John that we're going to look at today. Near the cross of Jesus stood his mother, his mother's sister, Mary, the wife of Clopas, and Mary Magdalene. So we've got three Marys and an unnamed aunt of Jesus, his mother's sister. When Jesus saw his mother there and the disciple whom he loved standing nearby, he said to her, "Woman, here is your son." And to the disciple, "Here is your mother." From that time on, this disciple took her into his home. So we talk about how Luke tried to get eyewitness testimony as much as he could. And of course, we know that Matthew was probably an eyewitness and wrote a lot of what he witnessed himself. And John, you know, we know did as well. Mark was sort of telling Peter's story. But this is not only eyewitness, this is like really personal first person. As John wrote, he called himself the disciple whom he loved. He's referring to himself. He wouldn't call himself by name. And so this is a very personal testimony. Now, several things made John the logical choice for the honor of being trusted to care for Jesus' mother. First of all, he was there. He was apparently the only male disciple of Jesus who was close enough to the cross for Jesus to speak to. But I'm not suggesting that Jesus chose John by default, you know, just because he was there. There was a reason that John was the only male disciple who was there. It's because he was politically connected. At least that's how we take the meaning of verse 15 of chapter 18. Simon Peter and another disciple were following Jesus because this disciple was known to the high priest. And again, another disciple, John won't mention himself by name, but he calls himself just another disciple. This disciple, the one who Jesus loved, was known to the high priest. He went with Jesus into the high priest's courtyard, but Peter had to wait outside at the door. The other disciple, who was known to the high priest, came back, spoke to the servant girl on duty there and brought Peter in. That was at the trial. This was before Jesus was on the cross. So again, most think that John chooses not to identify himself correctly or directly. And so we conclude that this is John. The significance of this is that his political connections provided him a little protection that the others didn't have. And this would actually be a good thing later on for Jesus' mother, because this movement was very controversial. And the families of political enemies were sometimes persecuted or even executed in situations like this. But a second reason that John was a logical choice to care for Jesus' mother was his youth. He was the youngest of the disciples, and the life expectancy for men at this time was somewhere between 30 and 40 years. I've read somewhere, maybe a little different from that. But women often lived a lot longer, and so the odds would be in John's favor to be sure to be alive until Mary died. And so add to that what Jesus may have already known, rather than having to just play the odds. Turn to or look at chapter 21. And this is after Jesus has been resurrected. And so they're with Jesus. Peter turned and saw that the disciple whom Jesus loved, again, this is John, was following them. This was the one who had leaned back against Jesus at the supper and had said, "Lord, who is going to betray you?" When Peter saw him, he asked, "Lord, what about him?" Jesus answered, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you? You must follow me." Because of this, the rumor spread among the believers that this disciple would not die. But Jesus did not say that he would not die. He only said, "If I want him to remain alive until I return, what is that to you?" This is the disciple who testifies to these things and who wrote them down. We know that his testimony is true. So John finally lays claim to what is written here. All right. As it turned out, traditionally at least, of course, John didn't live until Jesus returned, but he is thought to be the only one of the 12 who died of natural causes instead of being crucified. Or as in Paul's case, he wouldn't have been crucified because he was a Roman citizen and they weren't allowed to crucify Roman citizens. And so he was traditionally at least beheaded. But all of them were actually martyrs. And so these are interesting factors when we look at John. But I think that Jesus' reasons surely went beyond just logic. Jesus knew John's heart. Now, John didn't start out the way that we might think that he would have. But Jesus knew the heart of this young man, even though Jesus had nicknamed him and his brother James Boanerges, which means sons of thunder. Well, why was that? Well, look back at Luke 9. As the time approached for him to be taken up to heaven, Jesus resolutely set out for Jerusalem. That means that Jesus knew he was going to die, but he was headed to Jerusalem anyway. And he sent messengers on ahead who went into a Samaritan village to get things ready for him. But the people there did not welcome him because he was heading for Jerusalem. You may remember that the Samaritans thought that Gerizim was the place he ought to be heading. So even though he had success with some Samaritans, not all of them were in agreement. So when the disciples James and John saw this, they asked, "Lord, do you want us to call fire down from heaven to destroy them?" But Jesus turned and rebuked them. So, in spite of this, Jesus saw this young man develop into the one who would later be called the disciple of love. And so Jesus knew that John's care for Mary would extend beyond food and lodging. Jesus didn't only want his mother to be fed, he wanted his mother to be loved. And he knew that no one would love her more than John. So I wonder how much comfort this provided to Mary at that moment. Maybe not much. Can you imagine what it must have been like to be any mother, at the foot of a cross with your son hanging naked, humiliated, pierced, and dying? Well, a mother's love is very strong stuff, and it runs deep. And in spite of the pain, she was there. But you know what runs as deep as a mother's love? A mother's grief runs just as deep. I don't think that my mother ever quit grieving over her firstborn son who was lost in an accident at school when he was 15 years old while she was just pregnant with me. But the reason is that, you know, love is not a pie where, you know, especially not a mother's love. If it were a pie, each piece would reduce the whole until there would be none left, right? So you've got six children, your pie is cut into six slices, each child gets one slice. Well, a mother's love is not measured in limited quantities. If it were, the more children a mother had, the less love that each child would receive. An only child would have more love than any one child who had brothers or sisters. My mother would have taken the love that she had for her son Carl Roy and spread that among the other children. And they should have had a little more of her love because he died. And then when I was born 3 months after he died, they would have had to share her love once again in the same proportions as before because there were the same number of children. Well, this kind of thinking sounds absurd to anyone who was not an only child and had an average or better mother. We all need to learn to love like a mother. We can give the whole pie to every child and every person without having less to give to others. And that's good, but it's also very difficult because a mother cannot simply accept the loss of one child and then just give all of her love to the other children. Her grief may even interfere with her mothering if she's not able to grieve in a healthy way. So the question is, what was Mary feeling? So here's Mary, like my own mother, watching her firstborn son die for no just reason. So what might have been going through her mind? You know, what do you think she was thinking about at that moment? You know, was it the first sight of the bloody little baby after the hours of labor before she wrapped him up? You know, was it the top of his little head as he instinctively latched onto her breast for that first taste of milk? Was it the first little project that Joseph helped him make to give to her? You know, the way that he comforted her and took care of the family after Joseph died and he apparently became the head of the family. Maybe she regretted that she hadn't really believed in what he seemed to be doing. You know, she had thought that he was crazy to be drawing attention to himself after his cousin John had been thrown into prison and had his head cut off, and she wanted him to just come home. She knew it would lead to this very moment. And yet it was no comfort at all to know that she was right. She could have shown more faith in him. At least she wouldn't feel like she was any part of the horrible sorrow on his face right now. And she may have felt a bit of that. Well, what was Jesus feeling? What was he feeling as he looked down and he saw his mother there and knew all of these feelings that were going through her? Did he have any sensation of having been betrayed by his own mother? I can't believe that such a thought even entered his mind. What he said to her and to John shows what he was feeling. He, at least, believes that there's purpose in his death. He is dying for the sins of the world, but he knows that she only sees her son dying for no sins of his own. He believes that there will be triumph through his death. She just feels defeated. His heart is breaking for her. The only thing that keeps him from using his power to step down and put his arms around her is the belief that his death will defeat the evil one and his resurrection from the dead will provide hope for all mothers who are forced to watch their children ravaged by the forces of evil. So why do we have to think about this sadness? I mean, this is supposed to be an upbeat day. Think about your moms. It's a day for warm fuzzies, no cold pricklies. Please. Well, I don't want to think about my own mother dying. I was there. It wasn't a sad scene, but it was not a happy scene in my mind, you know. And I certainly wouldn't have wanted her to watch me die. But one good reason to examine this painful scene is to remind us to share the pain of those who grieve. Mother's Day can actually be pretty sad for those whose mothers have died, those whose mothers were not what we think of as good mothers, those women who have not felt the joy of actually being a mother, those who watched their mothers being abused, those who were separated from their mothers by divorce, mothers whose children do not honor them. You know, so think of those that you know in your circle, in the church family, in your circle, who might be feeling some pain today, and reach out to them in some way. And I know there must be others of us who are feeling similar pain for one reason or another. So as those of us who have no tragic memories of our mothers celebrate, and we should celebrate, we want you to know that we are not forgetting you who may have some sadness. So this brings us to the ultimate reason that we need to examine the pain of Jesus' mother at the cross, and that is that we need to honor our mothers. And what better reminder could there be? Jesus honored his mother as he was dying on the cross. When I was very young, I told my mother that I wanted to die at the same time as her, because I could not imagine, you know, seeing her die, living without her. I grew out of that, of course. But this scene at the cross reminds us that unless Jesus returns while both you and your mother are living, you will be separated from your mother for some period of time by her death or your own. And so if this won't motivate us to, you know, call her, write her, send gifts, just pray prayers of thanksgiving for her if she's gone, and express our love in any way we can, then, you know, I don't know what will. So, no, you know, don't just think of doing it today on Mother's Day, a day that was created every day in our hearts all of the time. So once again, our lifestyle can get in the way. We no longer live within a stone's throw of our parents for all of our lives. You know, it used to be that you would pass your parents' house every day, and you'd be reminded if you were neglectful or if there was something wrong in your relationship with your mother. But we don't, you know, we don't necessarily live anywhere close to our moms anymore. And then our government sort of leads us to believe that it's the responsibility of the government to care for the needs of our parents. If they grow helpless, you know, then they're supposed to be moved into nursing homes when their own children could care for them. Now, our parents, some have even come to believe that it is somehow a sign of selfishness or weakness to allow their children to be inconvenienced by their parents' needs. So I'd encourage you to not ever take that position. If your kids can take care of you, then let them take care of you. If you can take care of your parents, then do so. Now, don't think I'm standing in judgment on any specific situation. There are circumstances that do require more care for parents than the children may be able to provide. And no one suffers as much as the children when that happens and the parents are in that condition. But all of us have failed our mothers at times, and we've not done right in the past, and so this is where we come for forgiveness. This, you know, here, symbolically and really. and strength to change. And so let's focus on the future. Communicate every good thing you can to your mother if she is still alive, and whether she is living or not, honor her by the way you live, no matter how she lived, okay? Do your mother proud, as we would say. So think of how John must have treated Mary. How do you think he treated Mary for the rest of her life? And make that your model. Let's pray together. Our Father,